Chapter 17. The Stranger's Power. We may infer from these facts what havoc the introduction of any new beast of prey must cause in a country before the instincts of the aborigines become adapted to the stranger's craft or power. Charles Darwin, Journal of Researches. In the Galapagos, large tracts of the highlands of Floriana, Santiago, San Cristobal, and Santa Cruz have been cleared for cattle pasture. Farmers have planted tomatoes, avocados, guavas, papaya, oranges, lemons, bananas, potatoes, cabbages, coffee, and a fruit known locally as Norwegian pear. On Santa Cruz, which is in sight of Daphne Major, the dirt road up through the highlands and over the summit of the island is full of wide views of these young orchards and pastures, and dotted with small white crosses like wayside shrines to commemorate fatal car accidents. Horses, donkeys, cows, and cattle egrets, all of them like human beings new to the islands, stand in the fields, through which a few giant Galapagos tortoises still wander or browse in green pond scum with Darwin's finches riding on their domes. The tortoises help the farmers by eating grapefruit, oranges, and lemons whenever they can, and dispersing the seeds throughout the uplands. The biggest settlement in the archipelago is the village of Puerto Ayora, on the southern shore of Santa Cruz. Darwin's finches are the sparrows of the village. In the cafes, while men call greetings to one another, mock distinguished epithets, capitán, profesor, the finches hop beneath their feet, looking for crumbs and spills. They hunt and peck in every dooryard garden and bathe in puddles in the middle of the dirt roads, braving the bicycles and pickup trucks. The local people call the finches chiques for the sound. They know the birds are famous, but they don't know why. They simply call them chiques, all of the finches, from the small-beaked to the big-beaked. The warblers are marias or canarios. Darwin knew that the finches could adjust their habits quickly to take advantage of the banquets spread by human beings. In the highlands of Floriana, he watched the birds stealing seeds from the fields of the Ecuadorian political prisoners. The grosbeaks are very injurious to the cultivated land, Darwin writes in his ornithological notes. They stock up seeds and plants, buried 6 inches beneath the surface. Similarly, Alfred Russel Wallace, in an essay on the variability of species, tells the story of the kea, a mountain parrot of New Zealand. Before Europeans began raising sheep in New Zealand, the kea fed on the honey of flowers and on the insects that buzzed around the flowers, rounding out its diet with fruits and berries. Soon after shepherds came to New Zealand, keas began picking at sheepskins hung out to dry and the mutton hung up to cure. The shepherds began finding sheep with raw and bleeding wounds on their backs. About 1868, Wallace says, some of the shepherds actually saw the parrots attacking their sheep. Since then, Wallace reports, it is stated that the bird actually burrows into the living sheep, eating its way down to the kidneys, which form its special delicacy. The shepherds, meanwhile, declared war on the parrots, shooting them on sight. The case, Wallace concludes, affords a remarkable instance of how the climbing feet and powerful hooked beak developed for one set of purposes can be applied to another altogether different purpose. And it also shows how little real stability there may be in what appear to us the most fixed habits of life. In the Galapagos, the lives of the settlers and Darwin's finches have almost instantly intertwined. Finches eat the flowers of the crops, says Fabio Peñafil, a young Ecuadorian naturalist and Galapagos guide who lives in the village of Puerto Ayora. The señora who lives next to me has had to give up planting pineapple in her garden, he says, because of the finches picking in the middle. Cactus finches and tree finches. It's nibble, 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 and no fruit will come out. The señora has eaten finches. Yes, she says they have a very mild taste. She makes finch soup. And of course she tells me that. She says, your finches, your silly finches have eaten my plants, but I have eaten the finches. Highly illegal, Finch Soup. The people at the station would just fall on their backs. But she was honest enough to tell me. Imagine what the people up in the highlands are doing when the finches are eating their crops. And after all, the finch population is probably increasing up there because of those crops. I don't like sentimentality. Facts are facts. At the Charles Darwin Research Station, which is just outside the village, Darwin's finches hop in the gravel between the low buildings, hunting for seeds among the pebbles and the pocked pale coral. They look down at visiting scientists from the edges of the corrugated roofs and the railings of the dormitory porches. They perch on the arrows along the tourist footpaths as if seeking evolutionary guidance. The flocks of finches are thickest outside the station's library, where the librarian, Gail Davies, throws rice to them, wearing a shirt tied at the waist and hair pulled back in a bun, tropical librarian fashion. She also feeds the finches on the veranda of her home, a mile down the dirt road from the station. There, she dumps the rice on a hanging tray, while dozens of fuliginosa, fortis, magnerostris, and scandens hop and cling to the wires, cheeping and snatching a few grains right out of her hands. Since my husband is gone a lot, he goes out to sea very often. It's nice to have living things around, Gail says. They are there in the morning. They're there at noon. And they are hopeful all day long. If someone comes to the house when I'm away, it's like spreading a rumor. All of a sudden, there's a flock. She used to keep the rice in an open bowl in the kitchen, and some of the finches, the most confident, would fly right in and feed from the bowl. Most preferred to wait until they were served outside. But some few who didn't like to eat with the hoi polloi would come right through the window to the inside bowl and eat in peace, even if the outside bowl was full, she says. This one day, I was inside the house, sitting on the bed reading. The house we lived in then was just one room. The bed doubled as a couch by day. So I'm sitting propped up on pillows, and a finch landed on a pillow right next to my head. And I could see that he had something wrong with his beak. It was pox. Pox shows normally on feet, but sometimes you get a nasty growth on the beak inside. I managed to scrape it off. Then I painted the spot with gentian violet. I tried to help him out. I never had a finch do that before, fly right up and look into my face. They cock their heads and look at you when you are feeding them, but this was something very different. It felt, to get thoroughly anthropomorphic, like a tiny cry for help. Of course, you'll never know. It could have been that he could not eat, was basically starving, and I was the source, the one who put out the rice. Who knows? To me, it felt like a help me. The arrival of human beings means a new phase in the evolution of Darwin's finches, and its directions are still unclear. On the inhabited islands, says Peter Grant, we haven't done studies of the effects of cats, rats, mice, dogs, goats, donkeys, fire ants, pineapples, bananas, or guavas, and so on. Are they having an effect on the finches? Strictly speaking, we don't know from our studies. We assume they are, he says, but we have observed none of these changes. Rosemary and Peter do think they see something odd about the finches of Santa Cruz. The birds around the research station and in the village seem to be blurring together. The Grants have never made a systematic study of this, but to their eyes the species almost look as though they are fusing. They just sort of run into each other, says Rosemary. There is no difference between the largest fortis and the smallest magnerostris. Really, we would need to compare the finches 100 years ago in that part of the island with what they are now, Peter says cautiously. But he and Rosemary wonder if the provision of so much water and food in Puerto Ayora may have enabled the birds' breeding densities to rise around the village. The struggle for existence may have grown less intense. As the growth of the village relaxes the selection pressures on generation after generation of finches, the birds may be turning into a hybrid swarm. This has not happened on Daphne or Genovesa because, as the Finch Unit has shown, the struggle for existence on those uninhabited islands is intermittently so intense. In hard times, the varied finch beaks have such great adaptive value that they are preserved again and again by natural selection. On Genovesa, for instance, late in 1983, after the Great Niño, the island was unusually lush and conditions were unusually soft for Darwin's finches, as they are all year round on Gail Davies' veranda. At that time, the depths of Conirostris and Magnirostris beaks on Genovesa were very variable, and the deepest Conirostris beak and the shallowest Magnirostris beak were close together. If conditions had continued lush, those finches would likely have continued to fuse. But the years 1984 and 1985 were one long dry period. "All the intermediates went out," says Rosemary, "died, to be more precise. All the finches whose measurements lay between Conirostris and Magnirostris died. In Magnirostris, length and depth went up. In Conirostris, they went down. As a result, the two species were divided by the selection episode," says Rosemary, gesturing with her hands as if she were drawing out a lump of clay. "The net result was divergence. You got an actual gap." So the Grants speculate that in places like Santa Cruz, where there is little selection against hybrids, some of Darwin's finches might yet merge. Human beings may have tipped the balance between fission and fusion. Around the villages and farms, many of the celebrated differences in their beaks may simply disappear. Some decades ago, the botanist Edgar Anderson wrote a speculative essay, "The Hybridization of the Habitat." Anderson is the evolutionist who coined the term introgressive hybridization to emphasize the point that the backcrossing of hybrids with the lines of either of their parents provides a means for the mixing of genes between the two lines, and so may be an important evolutionary step. In his essay, Anderson argues that the disturbances that human beings are visiting on the planet must be leading to increasing cases of hybridization everywhere, and that thousands of these hybrids and their habitats may prove to be the seedbeds of new evolutionary lines. In his view, the crucial evolutionary step comes not with the first hybrid generation, but with the second. "The first hybrid will be uniform in its requirements, and on the whole they will be for conditions intermediate between those required for the two parents," Anderson writes. This is just what the Grants are seeing with Darwin's finches. The first generation of hybrids is intermediate in beak and body. But from their offspring, surprises may come. The second generation will be made up of individuals, each of which will require its own peculiar habitat, Anderson writes, and repeats the statement in block letters. "The second generation will be made up of individuals, each of which will require its own peculiar habitat for optimum development." In other words, the offspring of hybrids will be novel and bizarre, and they will require habitats as novel and bizarre as they are themselves. Anderson showed how this might happen in a study of two species of spiderwort that grow wild in the Ozarks. One grows in deep, dark woods at the foot of cliffs, he says, while the other grows in full sun at the top of the cliffs. In many ways, these habitats are polar opposites. The species at the base of the cliffs requires rich loam, deep shade, leaf mold cover, while the species at the top of the cliffs requires rocky soil, full sun, no leaf mold cover. "The two spider warts," he says, "are well-differentiated species. Neither one of them is by any means the closest relative of the other. He could cross them readily in experimental gardens, where he learned to recognize the distinctive appearance of the hybrids. But he seldom found one of the hybrids growing in the wild, because the Ozarks rarely provided an intermediate habitat. Not even the very middle of the cliff would do." Anderson did find a few of these hybrids growing wild in the woods. "Imagine what would happen if these hybrids crossed," he writes. "Their offspring, by shuffling their diverse sets of genes, would now require six new habitats besides their parents' two: rich loam, full sun, no leaf mold, rocky soil, deep shade, leaf mold. Rich loam, full sun, leaf mold. rocky soil, full sun, leaf mold. Rich loam, deep shade, no leaf mold. Rocky soil, deep shade, no leaf mold. The actual number of differences between any two species is much greater than in this schematic example. What is more, Anderson points out, the number of different habitats the hybrids require will rise exponentially with the number of basic differences between the species. With 10 such differences, around 1,000 different kinds of habitat would be needed to permit the various recombinations to find a niche somewhere. With only 20 such basic differences, and this seems like a conservative figure, over 1,000,000 different recombined habitats would be needed. You don't find situations that chaotic under natural conditions, but you do find them in the havoc that human beings bring in their train. Our arrival, Anderson says, can provide strange new niches of hybrid recombinations. Thus, our disturbances hybridize both the environment and the species. We are hybridizing the planet. Botanists have actually watched this happening. Farmers on the Mississippi Delta treat their lands slightly differently, and botanists have discovered that different wildflower hybrids flourish in the different conditions on each farm. The land is the same, the climate is the same, but the hybrids, as Anderson writes, sometimes go right up to the fence line at the border of the farm and stop there. The same sort of pattern has been documented in the fields and pastures of the St. Lawrence Valley and elsewhere. One botanist has looked at two species of sage that grew in the chaparral of the San Gabriel Mountains. In the chaparral itself, he found no hybrids, but he did find them flourishing next to it in an abandoned olive orchard. In this greatly disturbed area, new niches were created for the hybrid progeny, which are apparently always being produced in the chaparral, but at very low frequency, Anderson writes. In this strange new set of various habitats, some of the mongrels were at a greater selective advantage. The sage in the deserted olive orchard was composed of hybrids, and almost none of the original species grew there. This kind of thing must have happened whenever new islands were colonized by wind-blown or seabird-carried seeds, as in the Galapagos. It must have happened whenever new continents were colonized by new plants and animals. At such times and places, Anderson argues, introgressive hybridization must have played an important role in evolution. In a paper he wrote with G. Ledyard Stebbins, Hybridization as an Evolutionary Stimulus, Anderson argues that what we are seeing now in the world is something the world has seen in one form or another many times before. We are ecological dominants, the two evolutionists write. But we are not the first to bestride the world in conquest. When the first land vertebrates invaded terrestrial vegetation, they must have been quite as catastrophic to the flora which had been evolved in the absence of such creatures. When the large herbivorous reptiles first appeared, and also when the first large land mammals arrived in each new portion of the world, there must have been violent readjustments and the creation of new ecological niches. This would have happened in the Hawaiian Islands, the Galapagos, Lake Baikal, wherever species belonging to different faunas and floras were brought together, and physical and biological barrier systems were broken down. It would have happened most recently in the upheavals of the Pleistocene, when ice sheets swept across the continents of the Northern Hemisphere, and there were ice caps even on the summits of the island of Hawaii. So in chaotic times after each deluge, hybridization may help the standard Darwinian mechanisms to run faster. By intensifying the pressure of selection everywhere on the world and disturbing habitats all over the world, we may be creating conditions in which evolution is running at its maximum rate. Anderson and Stebbins argue that the recent rapid evolution of weeds and semi-weeds is an indication of what must have happened again and again in geological history, whenever any species or group of species became so ecologically dominant as greatly to upset the habitats of their own times. Under our influence, as Anderson and Stebbins writes, evolution has been greatly accelerated, There has been a rapid evolution of plants and animals under domestication, and an almost equally rapid evolution of weed species and strains in greatly disturbed habitats. Normally, we think of the intrusions of weeds and introduced species as distractions from the great work of nature, the creative process of Darwinism. But this kind of upheaval has happened again and again, though never through the advent of a conscious dominant like ourselves, a conqueror come to watch. So what we are seeing is a specimen of evolution as it has happened again and again throughout the ages. Far from being without bearing on general theories of evolution, write Anderson and Stebbins, these events are of tremendous significance, showing how much more rapidly evolution can proceed under the impact of a new ecological dominant, in this case, man. The enhanced evolution which we see in our own gardens, dooryards, dumps, and roadsides may well be typical of what happened during the rise of previous ecological dominants, they write. We are doing what the dinosaurs did before us, only faster. We bring strangers together to make strange bedfellows, and we remake the beds they lie in all at once. Darwin and his shipmates collected 15 finches on the island of Floriana. 5 of them were an unusually large race, Magnirostris magnirostris, the biggest of Darwin's finches. They must have been extremely common on the island at the time, in old owl lairs on Floriana. The bones of this giant among finches are more than 12 times more abundant than any other finch. The evolutionist David Stedman has made a study of the great Galapagos finch. He notes that when Adolphe-Simon Nebu and Charles-René Augustin Leclanchet of the French frigate Venus collected birds on Floriana in 1838, only 3 years after Darwin, they did not find a single Magnirostris magnirostris. Neither did Thomas Edmondson of HMS Herald in 1846, or one Dr. Kinberg of the Swedish frigate Eugenie in 1852. In fact, Magnirostris magnirostris has never been seen since. It seems to have gone extinct almost immediately after Darwin's visit to the islands. Darwin was the first naturalist to collect a specimen and the last to see one alive. What happened to the giant finch of Floriana? No one on the island was observing it the way the finch unit is now watching Daphne. But it is certain that the birds were not wiped out by a volcanic eruption because Floriana has been dormant for as long as human beings have been in the islands. The finches almost certainly died because of another kind of eruption. The upheaval that human beings brought to their island. The culprit in their extinction is almost certainly the prison colony, which had been established only a few years before Darwin's arrival. There were 200 or 300 Ecuadorian prisoners on the island when the Beagle stopped there, as Darwin recorded in his journal. They had cleared farms in the highlands where they tended sweet potatoes and plantains. They hunted wild pigs and goats and feasted on the giant tortoises, and at least one family ate finch soup. In some ways, the arrival of the farmers was a bonanza for the finches. They made pests of themselves on the farms, as they are doing now on Santa Cruz. The grosbeaks that Darwin saw digging up seeds in the fields were almost certainly Magnirostris magnirostris. Unfortunately for the finches, however, the prisoners imported more than seeds to the island. They also brought cattle, goats, pigs, cats, and rats. And though the prisoners were soon gone, the colony lasted only a few years after Darwin's visit, their retinue of animals remained and multiplied. When Captain A.H. Markham of HMS Triumph visited the islands in 1880, he found it to be in undisturbed possession of the so-called wild cattle. He also saw donkeys, dogs, pigs, and other animals that had been left to run wild on the abandonment of the island by the former inhabitants. Magnirostris magnirostris were big birds and probably didn't fly much, even by the standards of ground finches, says Peter Grant. They must have been easy for rats and cats to jump on. To make matters worse for the finches, the local cactus went extinct. Magnirostris magnirostris was probably dependent on this cactus, which was an equally unusual local race called Megasperma megasperma, meaning big, big seed. The seeds of this cactus are the largest and hardest of any cactus in the Galapagos, about half an inch in diameter. A relic population of the giant cactus survives on a small outlying island, Champion, off the coast of Floriana. The Grants have tested its seeds with their McGill nutcracker. It rates a 20 on their scale for size and hardness, while the next toughest cactus seed in the Galapagos rates only just under 11. Megasperma megasperma produces these giant seeds in prolific numbers. Giant mags probably could crack those seeds, says Peter Grant, and for a relatively small investment of time get a big return. But any ordinary finch would find them impossible to crack. Almost certainly, the doomed Magnirostris magnirostris specialized in Megasperma megasperma. In fact, their beaks and the cactus seeds may have evolved in a kind of arms race, the finch's predations driving the cactus to make bigger and bigger seeds, and the bigger seeds driving the finches to bigger and bigger beaks. When the prisoners left Floriana, their abandoned cattle and donkeys learned to knock over the cactus and chew its flesh for water. In a very short time, there was almost no Megasperma megasperma left on the island. Without it, conditions for Magnirostris magnirostris may have become unlivable. Mockingbirds went extinct on Floriana too, at about the same time. Galapagos mockingbirds nest in cactus. Today, the scientists at the research station are trying hard to rescue many of the best beloved animals in the Galapagos, including iguanas, tortoises, and dark-rumped petrels. Living things on islands are more vulnerable than their relatives on continents because they are small in numbers and because they evolved apart from the dizzying welter of competition on the continents. Around the world, almost 100 species of birds are known to have gone extinct since the 17th century, together with more than 80 subspecies. More than 9 out of 10 of these lost species and subspecies lived on islands. If goats got onto Daphne, for instance, they would eat out the cacti, which would certainly drive Scandens extinct, says Rosemary. And if cactus and tribulus were both wiped out, that would finish all the finches with big beaks and medium-sized beaks. That is why the Grants take such extraordinary precautions each time they travel from Santa Cruz to the landing on Daphne, or to Darwin Bay on Genovesa. They do not want to bring even one pregnant fire ant with them. We'd be horribly upset, says Peter. Oh my God, yes, says Rosemary. Because that is not the island's natural state, says Peter. And if we were responsible, we'd be devastated. Every time they land on the island, they wash all the fresh food in salt water and the mist net's poles, too. Sometimes they tow the poles in the water all the way to the island to make sure stowaway ants are drowned. We always wash the tents and the bird bags, and we just sort of sanitize everything, says Rosemary. Usually, I take a can of spray just in case, but we've never had to use it. Fire ants would kill off all the scorpions, and probably the spiders, Peter says. And since these are small islands, the scorpions and spiders would probably go extinct. A lot of people would be happy to lose the scorpions and spiders, but then, as Peter retorts, a lot of people live in cities. If they killed the scorpions, that would affect the Tripodurus, the lava lizards, Rosemary says. But it is the general principle more than concern for any one species, says Peter. If any new species invades, the old balance is gone. The changes would reach through the food chains, says Rosemary. Yes, changes of unpredictable sorts. It would be very difficult to be sure of the consequences for organisms higher up in the food webs. The habitats we are watching are so sensitive and fragile, Peter says. It's easy to imagine major changes taking place on both islands. So few places have not been touched by humans, says Rosemary. You can imagine if a big hotel, a Holiday Inn, were built on Daphne or Genovesa with the introduced plants and insects and rats and cats, parrots, budgerigars. You'd get Daphne and Genovesa just totally destroyed. On the Hawaiian Islands, which were once the most isolated archipelago in the world, human beings arrived near the beginning of the first millennium. Many other aggressive species landed with us in accelerating waves, including pigs, goats, rats, mongooses, mosquitoes, army worms, bookworms, cockroaches, centipedes, and scorpions, not to mention the English sparrows and more than 4,500 species of alien plants. Beneath these tidal waves, the adaptive radiations of native birds in the archipelago have been crushed. Species of finches, hawks, owls, flightless ibis, and flightless rails have gone extinct. The finches have been hit particularly hard. Even casual observers have noted a kaleidoscope of shifting dominance by different species of alien birds over the past 30 years, says one ecologist, Peter Vitusek. The one constant has been the near absence of natives. In the far north and west of the Hawaiian archipelago, there is an atoll called Laysan. The adaptive landscapes of this remote island were turned upside down in the 19th century by the arrival of European rabbits and rats. In 1967, in a sort of Noah's Ark project, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service took away more than 100 specimens of an endangered species of Hawaiian finches and carried the birds by boat about 500 kilometers, more than 300 miles, to a small cluster of Hawaiian islands known as Pearl and Hermes Reef. After the Laysan finch was introduced to this reef, Sheila Conant, an ornithologist at the University of Hawaii, inspired by the Grant's work in the Galapagos, began watching the birds in their new home islands. The Laysan finches are as tame as Darwin's, and Conant and a few field assistants have been able to band most of them. She could not watch the birds almost continuously the way the Grants and their teams of watchers have managed to do, but she has made a few expeditions to the islands spaced several years apart. Conant found that within 20 years of their introduction to the islands of Pearl and Hermes Reef, the finches had begun to go off in different directions. On Laysan, their ancestors had had shallow, wide, medium-length beaks. Now, in their new home, the finches on Southeast Island have longer beaks, while the finches on North Island have shorter, deeper, narrower beaks. These are grain-eating finches. The seeds they take range from very small and soft to big and hard, the toughest of all being, once again, tribulus, which probably got to Hawaii the same way it got to the Galapagos, hitching rides on sailors and whalers. Tribulus is not common on Laysan, but it is one of the main plants on Pearl and Hermes Reef. Correspondingly, the finches in their new home spend much more time working on tribulus, and the tribulus mericarps on Southeast Island are larger than on North Island, which may explain the divergence in the beaks of these finches. The speed with which these finches have adapted is amazing, and it shows how fast the primo-progenitors of Darwin's finches may have adapted when they first came to the Galapagos. Are we tinkering with evolution? Asks Sheila Conant. The answer is, of course, yes. As more and more species are endangered, more and more well-meaning attempts to save them involve introducing them to new homes or reintroducing them to their old homes. What happens next in these cases will seldom be monitored as closely as the Grants are watching Daphne, and Conant is watching Laysan. But it is clear from these studies that the introduced species, if it survives, can evolve rapidly and unpredictably in its new homes. To Conant, this is intriguing and perplexing. Conservationists may be frustrated to find that by moving a species, instead of helping it to survive, they have helped it evolve into a new form. That is why Rosemary and Peter put the word dynamic in the title of the first book they wrote together, Evolutionary Dynamics of a Natural Population. It's important to keep in mind, says Rosemary, species don't stand still. You can't preserve a species. Every species is, as the Grants write in the last words of their book, constantly changing and capable of further change. All of which brings home a bittersweet message, as Peter Boag wrote in Nature on the centenary of Darwin's death. Much less is known about evolution in the Galapagos than most people think, but Galapagos populations and communities are probably now changing faster than ever.